But before Twitter, we are talking about human-robot interactions. And no, I'm not referring to the relationship between Kerry O'Brien and Anthony Green on election night broadcasts. We're talking about the cutting edge of robot technology and how to make those very flawed machines called human beings deal better with robots. Apparently, the answer is that human reactions are so hardwired that it's easier to get the robots to change. And a woman who is leading the charge to do that is a social scientist, Dr. Layla Takayama. Now, Layla works at Willow Garage, which is a personal robotics incubator in San Francisco. I'm not sure how many personal robotics incubators there are in San Fran, but that's certainly she's certainly the first guest we've spoken to from such an organization on Friday Drive. Now, they focus on the implications of people working alongside robots, which is coming soon to your workplace. So how is it that a social scientist ends up working with robots? Well, I spoke to Layla earlier this week.
You kind of stumble into it, which is the way that I did it. So when I was in college, I was doing a bunch of, you know, working as a little undergrad research assistant in the psychology department at Berkeley. And, you know, it was kind of neat, but I kept wanting to apply what we were learning to the design of, you know, products and systems and, you know, cool things that have computers in them. And so I got drawn into actually doing more research in the computer science department. And that's kind of how I got started at this intersection of social science and, you know, human-computer interaction, looking more at the tech and, like, how do you take what we know about people and apply that to the design of new systems?
Does it mean then that your work could be applied to, say, the way a laptop computer or a car or a phone is designed, but you've taken it to the whole new level of actually applying it to you know, moving machines and robots that look like the sorts of things we see in movies?
Yes, that's right on. I actually started out doing more research on sort of sensor-based systems and cars and mobile phones, and I decided that robots actually needed more help than computer products do. Because if you look at the design of these things, my goodness, they need more designers and social scientists to weigh in before they're going to ever make it into people's homes.
Yeah, might that perhaps have something to do with the fact that the sort of people who work in advanced robotics maybe need the assistance of a social scientist even when they're not at work?
Maybe. I mean, I think we both need each other.
Good, right? Excellent, well done.
If they weren't making robots, I wouldn't have anything to work on. But the cool thing about robots is that, you know, they're already very interdisciplinary. You can't just be a software programmer and do robots. You can't just be a mechanical engineer and do robots. You actually need both.
Okay.
And the electrical engineers. So it's a big mix no matter what. So just throwing in a few fuzzies doesn't make it a whole lot different.
Right. So can you give us an example of the sort of insight or suggestion that you might make based on your research to somebody who's dealing with, say, the mechanical engineering of a way a particular robot might work?
Sure. So one of the things that we've actually done recently is we've had a lot of arguments about how tall the robot should be, and that influences mechanical things, right? Like how stable is it
if
it's tall? Or, you know, how short should it be? And a lot of folks say, you know, I want it to be just like a human, and I'm not in that camp. So we ran a bunch of experiments that look a lot like psychology experiments where we manipulate how tall the robot is, and then we look at how people react to them. And in our case, we were looking at telepresence robots. And a lot of people say, I want my robot to be really tall because then I'll have lots of authority. But that can be intimidating. It turns out that actually, you know, if you're a boss that's using a telepresence robot to talk with people who report to you, it does help for you to be more persuasive when you're in a taller robot than in a shorter one.
Okay, so just to roll back there, a telepresence robot, we're talking about somebody who, a robot who is effectively manifesting a human's presence in a situation. Is that right?
Yeah, think of it as kind of like a physical avatar. Some people call it, you know, Skype on wheels. And the basic idea is that, it's kind of a robot, but it's kind of not, because it's just, you know, your remote presence in another geographical location.
So at the moment, am I speaking to your avatar on wheels, or is this actually Layla Takayama?
This is actually me,
but you
are talking to my voice over the internet.
So it's not that, not that different. I could have you as a guest in the studio if I had a robot
on
hand.
Exactly.
Right, okay. All right.
Right.
It seems to follow from that then that you can, design the physicality of robots to reflect whatever personality, so to speak, you want. If you want a tall, authoritarian robot, you can do that, or you can have, you know, soft, cuddly bosses, and presumably you can design the full range of humans and beyond.
Absolutely. And actually, the folks who know how to do that better than the social scientists are actually the character animators, yet another industry.
Yeah, because you've worked with people from Pixar, is that right?
Yeah, actually, yeah, we work with Doug Dooley, who we actually hired here full-time, because we need his help for figuring out, you know, what should the character of this robot be like? What kind of personalities should it embody? And he knows how to do that, right? What should it be shaped like? How should it move? How should it behave to be consistent with the single character style?
On RN Drive, we're speaking with Dr. Lila Takayama, who is a research scientist in the area of human-robot interaction. Lila, do you actually program software for robots, or is it about the physical appearance?
It's both. I do a little bit of prototyping and software, but usually our software engineers look at my code and then they decide they want to rewrite it because they can do it better than
right,
I can.
Right. But what are you trying to achieve in the code that you write?
So the code that I was writing was trying to use sort of sound design in order to make the robots a little safer to be around. So our robots would back up like a truck.
All right, okay, they beep when they go backwards.
Yeah, right. Yes, so the first thing we did was make them beep like a truck when it's backing up, because you can't really tell that the robot can't see anything behind it. So we use cues from cars to make it a little safer for people to be around them.
Okay.
We've been looking at things like turn signals also.
Lala, you work at the Willow Garage in the San Francisco Bay Area. What sort of robots do you work with there? And can you tell us a little bit about open source software for robots?
Sure. So the types of hardware that we work with are something that's called the PR2, and that stands for Personal Robot 2. It's a 500-pound mobile manipulation platform, which means it's a big robot that runs around and grabs stuff. And it's designed to work in human environments, meaning that you don't have to put it behind a cage for it to be safe enough for people to be near. Another robot that we use a lot is called the Turtlebot, and that's a little guy. He's sort of, you know, a little hobby robot built on top of the robotic vacuum cleaners. So that one's a good entry point for people getting into robotics. Finally, we work a lot with telepresence robots, so robots that we now call remote presence devices because they're not really robots at all, and that's the Skype on wheels. So we look at different versions of that to figure out what would be the most effective way to actually design them. In terms of software, we do open source software with the BSD license, and what that means is that anybody can use our software for pretty much whatever they're doing, including commercial enterprises. And the reason for doing it open source is because we really wanted to help facilitate a personal robotics industry. So you can imagine like Linux and what Linux has done for personal computing, right? Actually, a lot of applications today, including things like Google, are written on top of Linux. We wanted to make the Linux for robotics so that people could build upon a common base without having to reinvent the wheel all the time.
Is there then a tension in the robotics research community, or maybe it's two communities, of people who are committed to the idea of open source software and people who are only looking to develop proprietary solutions that they might be able to, you know, presumably own and control?
Absolutely. Just as there's, you know, tension between the open source and closed source communities in computing, the same thing is there in robotics. The thing is that robotics is too young for them, I think, to have that kind of attitude. So if you have a shared, open, common base layer, and then you develop your own proprietary software on top of that with, you know, fancy capabilities that are specific to a certain market, that's okay, because we still, that gets the industry going. So it's not that we don't like closed source, it's just that we think there's more power in developing the open source versions first.
So does that mean when the robot war comes, you think the open source robots will win?
Well, I bet those robots are going to be based on the same open source. Yeah.
All right.
I don't know if they'll win, yeah, right. But we'll see.
We'll stay tuned. Look, we've talked about the way that the design that you put into the robots impacts on the way humans perceive them. Can it work the other way round as well? Are there things that a social scientist can do to teach a robot to interact better with, you know, those terribly flawed machines called people?
Yes, there are many ways to do it. So the interesting thing about people is that even though we know that robots are just tools and they're just machines, we have this habit of treating them as if they're more alive, and they're more like agents. So they're maybe a little more like your dog at home.
Mm.
So just because they can't talk to you doesn't mean that they don't have some kind of agency inside of them. So what we've done to take advantage of that is to use social cues in the robot so that it helps to trigger people's, you know, sort of appropriate responses. So say if you get too close to the robot and you're actually not in a safe zone, the robot could do something like shy away from you, looking a little bit scared,
right?
So that you know that, you know, maybe you're in the robot's personal space. And rationally, that doesn't make sense. But when you're actually, you know, in the moment of interacting with the robot, you kind of can't help but fall back on those old habits.
Right. So you're kind of designing into the robots the ways humans are going to react to them. Does that mean you can teach them things like manners, social customs? Can you know, can you make robots into better friends?
I think we can. The interesting thing about the social stuff, right, is that it tends to vary by culture.
Mm.
So you might notice that a lot of the Japanese robots, which are very advanced, especially in terms of hardware, most of them can bow.
Mm.
And I don't think that's a coincidence.
Right.
If you look at a lot of the American robots, they don't do that. And, you know, maybe there's a reason for that. So there's a lot of things I think that we can do to sort of take from what we know about social science, not just cognitive science, right?
On the flip side of that, what do American robots tend to do?
They tend to be used in factories. They'll be on, you know, an assembly line.
Right.
Or they'll be used in the military. So they do things like bomb disposing robots. They're machines. They're designed that way. But we're trying to change that with the personal robotics industry.
Do you have a sense of whether the issues 10 or 20 years down the track, when presumably technology has advanced hugely, whether it will be a case of the same issues applying to new technological developments, or can you predict a point at which the whole ball game changes?
I think it's going to change slowly just because social norms tend to change, you know, not in an instant, but over time as communities sort of decide how we're going to treat these machines, right? Do we give them rights and responsibilities, or do we keep saying that, no, they're just tools? I think there may be a shift as the technology advances. We're going to see, I mean, right now, most of the many useful robots, say like in robotic surgery, are actually driven by people. And even drones are largely driven by people. And over time, you might see little bits of autonomy making that driving and operating easier. But the day of having, you know, the supposedly fully autonomous robot is way out there. Right now, I'd say that's still too far in sci-fi.
Okay, so it's still a long way away. We don't know which code sourcing is going to win the war, but when it comes, I can tell you, I will tell all the robots that I know or have spoken to Dr. Leila Takayama, and hopefully that'll help. Thank you so much for speaking with us on RN Drive.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's fun.
Dr. Leila Takayama there from Willow Garage, a place which sounds a bit less scientific or robotic than it actually is. But she does seem to have the future of human-robot interaction well under hand, which is a relief for flawed machines like myself.